This Week in Radio Tech is supported in part by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource. That's thebdr.net. thebdr.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
From bits to bytes, from megahertz to feed horns, hold on to your microwave, you're about to get twirted.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
On the show, Chris Tobin and Chris Tarr, plus Tom Ray, and a special guest appearance by Rich Parker.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and along with me today we've got from Milwaukee, Chris Tarr. Hello, Chris.
Hello there, Kirk.
Otherwise known as the Geek Jedi.
That's me.
And Chris, you work for Entercom, is that right?
I work for Entercom. I'm the Director of Engineering for their Milwaukee and Madison markets.
Chris, excuse me for interrupting one second. As we talked on the show before the show, I'm at a rich guy's house in Buenos Aires, Argentina. I'm very lucky to be working for the guys at Telos. Okay, that's my disclaimer. I have just been brought a plate. Oh, this isn't even the main plate. I've been brought a plate of appetizers of Argentinian barbecue. So while you guys are discussing in the second half of our show, I'll be chowing down on these lovely hors d'oeuvres. And
you know, some would say that's not polite. You should hold that off till we're done. Just saying.
And others of us think you should put them in a box and ship them up
right here
overnight.
Unless you're going to share with the rest of the class here. Well, that's not fair.
I'm sure U.S. Customs would have a field day with that.
Yeah, we'd get the bones to prove it.
So, Chris Tarr, your website is?
My website is broadcastdoc.net.
Broadcastdoc.net.
Correct.
Cool. And also along with us, the other Chris Tobin. Hello, Chris Tobin.
Hello, everyone.
And you are with CBS Radio, right?
Yes, I am. CBS Radio in New York City.
In the most exciting city in the world.
Absolutely.
I think you've got a cool job.
Well, actually, I do. I enjoy it. As a broadcast technologist, try this again, broadcast technologist, it's a lot of fun.
Well, during the show, Chris, we're going to try to pick your brain on some of these interesting IP issues we're going to be talking about. Also with us is Thomas R. Ray III.
Greetings.
Hi. Are you in your ham shack?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the ham radio is behind me, and I finally got the amplifier put back together, so I'm in good shape.
You know, Tom, if you will send me a picture of your ham shack, I will put it on the This Week in Radio Tech website.
I can do that.
I think that'd be very cool. It's a neat place. Yeah. Chris is, Tom is the Vice President of Engineering for Buckley Broadcasting, which includes the world-famous WOR in New York.
Yes, sir. Right down there on beautiful Broadway.
The opinions of the hosts are their own, and sometimes they're even mine.
Oh, God.
All right. Gentlemen, without further ado, let's jump right into a few technical discussions here about radio technology. If you're tuning into our podcast for the first time, welcome in. This is a podcast where we talk about all the things that happen in radio broadcasting technology. And this includes a myriad of things, from tower structural analysis to IP audio to getting the best quality out of a vinyl record to transmission and audio processing and just a whole myriad of things. So,
and how to get, you know, Coca-Cola out of a console that a DJ spilled into it, you know, things like that.
And how to get Coca-Cola out of a locked Coke machine.
There you go.
And how to hook things up to the chair for the DJ to get even for the Coca-Cola in the console.
You know, a photo flash capacitor works real well on that.
So, without further ado, let's jump right in. Tom, we had nice email from Stu Engelke. He's from the New York City area, right?
Yes, he's chief engineer of WMCA and the Apple AM 970 in New York.
Now, in fact, WMCA, those are kind of famous call letters, aren't they?
Oh, they sure are. They were in a classic fight for top 40 radio with WABC in New York in the 1960s.
So Stu asked a question about how we do this podcast. Tom, what did he ask?
Well, he asked specifically who was using which type of ISDN codec and who was maybe on a Comrex vector, and was anybody using VoIP, and I told him flat out, we do this on Skype. And he was flabbergasted.
So we that's true. We do this on Skype. I'm sorry. I have a mouthful of Argentinian barbecue.
See, it's already starting with the food.
Look at that. Look, it's really polite. That's nice. That's just
at
nice.
Least you know. At least the video turned off. We don't have to watch him doing it.
You know, come on, Kirk. I've got the barbecue sauce dripping down my monitor.
You know, we need Wonka vision. We need Wonka vision.
So you're giving me a chance to finish the food here.
But yes, we do this on Skype.
We can all.
We're all on Skype, and is everybody still there?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Kirk is recording this on his MacBook Pro using a plugin for Skype called Call Recorder, really original name there. And we're all connected on Skype. We all have good enough bandwidth to be served up with the Silk V3 codec. Now, this is apparently the latest codec from Skype. And Chris Tobin, you were telling me you know something about this codec and are putting it to use yourself.
Yes, actually, the earlier versions of Skype had a codec that was somewhat limited. This codec is actually it learns. It's like fuzzy logic. It learns its path. So if it's on a pipeline that's having trouble, it actually will adjust the bandwidth, audio quality, jitter, delay, everything, and give you the best connection possible. We've been using it in our newsroom with the reporters in the field, and it's been working out really well. The only problem we do run into is with the network, the Skype servers, if you're using that, what they call it, super user connection, and you tend to bounce around other machines to get bandwidth connectivity, it falls apart. If you do point-to-point, sounds really good. It does fall apart, though, if you're in a very noisy environment, or I'll call it complex audio, and then it starts to get squirrely.
Also, if there's crowd noise or wind or leaves rustling or general commotion?
Yes.
So the Silk codec works best on a dry, alone voice, right?
Works best with voice. We have put music through it. It does work well, but as with most of these codecs, the level going into the codec is key, and in the field, it's very difficult to control that.
Ah, tough to control the level. Now, Chris Tobin, you mentioned that if you get a peer-to-peer or point-to-point connection, it works best instead of going through some super user. What do you do to help ensure that when a reporter is in the field using Skype, how do you ensure that they get back to your studio directly?
Oh, we set them up with a direct IP address. We do static IPs at the receive end and have them do it that way when we have the luxury. Otherwise, we have a lot of freelancers or stringers who will provide content for us, and then I just have to let them run through the Skype servers and hope for the best.
Okay. Tom, you guys at WOR, are you doing anything with Skype out in the field at this point?
Well, you'd be surprised on the weekends and such what actually goes on. A lot of our weekend programs are out in the field, and we have a couple of hosts right now that are using the video portion of Skype so they can see the host who's sitting in the studio.
Oh.
And that way they look at each other and they have a more natural flow on the show.
All right, Chris Tarr at Entercom in Milwaukee. You guys using Skype or for any of your remotes?
Yeah, we're just getting started with it. Mainly, though, for things like TalkBack and situations like that, we really haven't used it on the air yet. But the one thing I do want to add is that what's real important with this codec and what we've all done is, especially for a situation like this, spending money on a decent microphone will make all the difference in the world with this stuff.
You bet.
That is true with every one of these codecs.
Well, that's another good subject. Since Stu Engelke asked about the audio quality, Chris Tobin, what are you using for a microphone right now?
I'm using the Crown Electret mic that you mount on a Sony MDR-7506, believe it or not.
Okay.
That Crown microphone, the CM311AHS, I believe it's called.
What? I'm not familiar with that mic. What does it look like?
It looks like a Madonna microphone. You actually attach it to the side of a Sony headphones.
Ah, okay.
And
so
a little bar comes out.
Okay.
And I could do the Vogue right now, and people will look at me, and this is the best part. And, actually, I should disclose that my location tonight is not in New York City. I'm actually in Atlantic City at the Borgata Hotel for
lucky
a broadcast we're doing tomorrow morning on WFAN.
Lucky you.
And feeling poorer.
No, it's good thing is I don't gamble, but I'm sitting in a very palatial, what they call the boardroom. It's a waiting area, very nice seats, Greek columns, a very high ceiling, huge chandeliers with lots of glass, and that Yo-Yo Ma type music playing in the background.
Aren't we all just in the lap of luxury tonight?
Yes, I still prefer the meat that you're enjoying.
That's right. So, Tom Ray, what kind of mic are you using there?
Well, I'm using an Electro Voice RE6D, and unfortunately at the moment I'm plugged right into the mic amp on the front of the computer. I've got to get an external mic amp. It'll sound better. But the first night we did this show, I was up at one of our other stations, and I had an RE20 microphone into a mic processor, and it was basically the voice of God.
I remember that. Chris Tarr, how about yourself?
I'm using the Blue Snowball, and I'll send a link to put on the site. It's actually pretty cool.
You know,
it looks like a big white snowball.
Most of these podcasts, I use a violet, looks like the snowball. It's got a different name, and I'll think of it in a minute. But it's blue and violet are somewhat they were somewhat related companies. But I happen to know the sales manager at Violet from Estonia. So I got a deal on a Violet microphone. And today, actually, I'm not using the Violet. I'm using an Audio Technica that is a USB microphone. It looks like it's a condenser mic. It's one of these big, large diaphragm condenser mics. But it instead of having a instead of requiring phantom power, it requires USB. So it's got the sound, you know, USB converter in the body of the microphone itself, because I didn't want to bring the, you know, the Violet microphone is a $2,000 microphone and it's very fragile. I didn't want to bring it all the way to Argentina and back, so I brought the slightly less expensive Audio Technica AT2020.
What you're saying is that mic is perfect for Top 40 Radio.
Okay. Well, let's see. We're going to I hope we've answered Stu Engelke's question that Skype is just amazing. And, you know, here's my prediction. I predict that you will see in the future appliances for broadcasters, both audio broadcasters and video broadcasters, that incorporates the Skype client inside this device. Anybody?
That wouldn't surprise me at all. That, matter of fact, it wouldn't surprise me if some of the field reporters who are over in Iraq and Afghanistan were possibly using Skype. I know they use satellite and limited satellite, limited bandwidth satellite, but it wouldn't surprise me if they were using Skype.
Well, here's a Skype interesting note for you. Once in a while, I live in Nashville, and we have a Fox affiliate there, Fox 17 WZTV, when they cannot find anybody to do the weather on their newscasts, when they're at the bottom of the list and they're scrambling, they call me. Yes, I do have a degree in meteorology, and I can, you know, stand up on TV in front of a green screen. So, last time I was at Fox 17, I noticed that their field reporters, when they have a breaking story outside of microwave range, they're using Skype over a Verizon or Sprint 3G modem with a video camera, and I mean a little webcam on a tripod. Now, the whole thing sounds pretty cheesy, but you know what? The reports that come back are actually not bad at all, and they're breaking, and the folks at Fox 17 have decided they don't want to spend the money on satellite trucks.
Wait, no, that's the thing about this technology.
Are they multiplexing the cards?
No, they're just using a single... They're not doing that system that can give you up to a megabit. They're just using a single 3G modem.
Interesting.
I do find it interesting how this technology has become kind of a great equalizer in a lot of ways. You know, what used to cost, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, some of the stuff that consumers can get their hands on are much better than things we had available to us 10 years ago.
You're
not kidding.
Yeah.
You're not kidding.
Oh, big time, yeah. That when things like YouTube came about, I mean, that kind of starts equalizing things right there when you can put up your own videos and be your own TV star.
Exactly. Hey, Kirk, with that video from the field on Skype, do they condition the video back at the TV station?
That's a good question. Now, I don't know. I don't know what they do to it to try to clean it up, brush it up. My guess is they don't do much because they do have an engineer on duty during the newscasts. But I don't know how much video sweetening he's doing.
Oh, okay. Because that Silk codec, I read about what it does, and it's actually pretty powerful.
Oh, so the same Silk codec is used for video as well?
My understanding is it's part of the Silk, yes.
Okay. Interesting.
That was the white paper I read. I haven't finished completely reading it. They've left out a few sections.
I know we've been talking about IP so much, but, you know, the whole world is going that way. And, by the way, our main subject in the podcast for you listening is in the second half of our podcast, we are going to in depth talk about studio-to-transmitter link technology for audio broadcasters. And we're going to cover the different methods used for STLs, what options are available, and, really interestingly, where do you put the audio processing, depending on what kind of link that you have, because there's optimal places to put it in different situations. So we'll get to that. I want to move on to our story about Clearwire. This is a company that I'm familiar with because Nashville, where I live, was an early city for them to open up in, one of the first four, I believe. Clearwire offers wireless IP services over using WiMAX technology, and they're opening into a number of new cities. I was slow in bringing up the list of cities here. Anybody else take a look at this or hear about Clearwire and their offerings?
No, I haven't.
I dealt with them. I talked with them at the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in Las Vegas. They're just rolling out as we speak. So Nashville and a few, Seattle, a few other places. New York City, I think, is scheduled first quarter next year.
They're
getting very aggressive.
Here's the story, let's see, Philadelphia, Seattle, Tacoma, Charlotte, Greensboro, Raleigh, Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio, and Honolulu, and also on Maui, they'll be rolling out these services. So my limited experience so far with WiMAX has been just terrific. Now, maybe when they sell to a lot of subscribers and the system gets pretty loaded up, it may not be as good, but I've had just great experience with WiMAX in Nashville.
Now, I'm kind of
amazed
that
capacity should be a problem. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's kind of I'm pleased to see this. It seems to me like Clearwire is kind of, for a long time in terms of a company and what they've been putting out, was kind of, we were wondering if it was going to be vaporware, because they've been around for a while and it's been kind of these fits and starts and trying to form these alliances to get things launched. So I'm glad to see that it's finally going to get there and bring something else to the table other than just cellular data.
Okay. So you're saying that as a competitor to cellular data. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they're the competitor to LTE that Verizon and I think AT&T is going with. That's who they're going to be going up against, LTE.
Yeah. And LTE, didn't that come along a bit after WiMAX, and isn't it regarded as probably a better technology?
Yes, depending on who you talk to. The problem is the technologies are about the same. How they deploy them or manipulate the data is the key. But both do very well. LTE has been optimized for more of a mobile environment. WiMAX is mobile, but I think they're still working out the protocols with the IEEE.
Okay. All right. Anybody else have a comment before we move on? More cities getting WiMAX. How about this? I read there's a new filing window for NCE, non-commercial educational FMs. Can anybody tell me what that means? Okay.
I know part of it. I'm a little bit involved with one. With the demise of like Television Channel 6, there's been a problem in the past with the non-commercial FM stations at the bottom of the band, because Channel 6 abuts the bottom of the FM band.
And
the non-commercial stations.
TV Channel 6 is right next to the non-commercial band, and I'm taking it, this limits how many non-commercial stations you can have when there's a Channel 6 in the area.
Well, it doesn't necessarily limit the stations, but when there's a Channel 6 in the area, what they normally require is that you either transmit a vertically polarized signal, or they require you to go directional with your FM antenna to certain parts. To the main. With the reception of Channel 6, but now that that's kind of gone away, what they've done is they've opened up a window, and some stations are filing for either power increases or filing for stations closer to the bottom of the band.
Ah, okay, okay. And so then, because of the switch to digital, you're saying some channel sixes have gone away. There used to be an analog channel six, and now there's a channel six no more, right?
That's correct. And in this one particular market, the CEO of our company graduated from a particular college, and their channel six went away, so we immediately filed for a power increase for the station, which they haven't been able to get because of the Channel 6 situation there.
You know, I was involved years ago with a non-commercial FM going on the air, and we had to be vertical only because the Channel 6 emissions are typically, TV emissions, are oftentimes horizontal only. And so if one was polarized vertically and one was polarized horizontally, it would minimize the chance of interference between a non-commercial FM close to Channel 6 and a TV station actually on Channel 6. Have I got that right?
That's correct, but it's more precisely, most of the receiving antennas are polarized horizontal. The TV stations would normally transmit a circularly polarized signal.
Oh, okay.
What they did in the case of this station, this college station I'm thinking of, is it was like, I'm going to say the horizontal component. They did allow them to transmit a horizontal component, but it was something like only 10% of the vertical component, so it was nothing.
Well, they also a lot of times will have you co-locate with the Channel 6 in the area.
Thank you, Chris.
Well.
I was going to mention that if you're co-located, then there is less potential for interference because the signals emanate from the same spot on the Earth and they decrease by the law that they decrease by? The something squared law.
Oh Lord! Yeah, we're a bunch of engineers here.
I always call it logarithmic.
So the signals are always decreasing together. If you have separately located Channel 6 and non-commercial low on the band FMs, people who live close to the transmitter for the FM are likely to receive interference to their viewing of Channel 6.
Well, that's correct, and when you have both transmitters on the same tower, the Channel 6 is almost always going to be significantly less power than the television station, so
yeah.
Significantly less chance of interference.
Okay.
Now, Chris and Tom, I've seen this. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but when as soon as the sunset was announced for analog TV in some of these Channel 6 markets like here, we saw these flurries of kind of preemptive applications to do things, and the FCC stepped in and said, nope, you can't do that until the stations are sunsetted, and then we'll open up or we'll make an announcement about opening up a window. But it was interesting because there's almost this gold rush mentality. As soon as the final cutoff date for analog TV came around, all of these filings kind of like this application would be based on Channel 6 going away at this certain time and, you know, people trying to get in that way. I don't know if you guys saw that in areas where you guys have seen, Channel 6 applications.
Well, the situation,
New York City doesn't have Channel 6. But Philadelphia, right, Tom? Isn't Philadelphia having an issue with the Channel 6?
Yes, Chick, because they decided to take the digital and put it back on Channel 6, and it's not working out for Channel 6.
Yeah.
but no, in the situation I'm involved in, the Channel 6 went away, but we had asked the commission, several months ago, if we could file an application based on Channel 6 going away, and they said, absolutely not, until everything's done. So we've had this application sitting here just waiting for the day we could file it.
Ah, okay. So people who think about this quick and early don't have an advantage. They're being told to wait.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. All righty. We think we had one more thing I wanted to ask you guys about, and that is... this story about the Senate Judiciary Committee passing a Performance Rights Act. This somehow, something about this doesn't sound good for broadcasters. Sounds like we got to get a checkbook out.
It probably does, and it doesn't sound right to me, seeing as, we play the music, and if it weren't for all the radio stations, you wouldn't have a lot of these groups we have today.
You know, that was a really solid argument before the Internet came along. And I'm wondering if broadcasters are having a hard time making that argument stick, since so many artists now have gone their own way, even divorced themselves from their record companies. A few weeks ago, I actually got invited to go to the home recording studio of country artist Gretchen Wilson. She lives outside of Nashville. I didn't see Gretchen. I met her very nice studio manager, Ryan Nelson. But she has a home studio, and she recorded most of her upcoming album at that home studio, and there's no record company involved with its distribution. She divorced herself from, I think it was Sony. So she's doing it, her own company, I believe it's called Studio 27, is doing the whole distribution and promotion on their own.
Interesting.
So now, of course, they're targeting radio stations for their promotion. So they haven't entirely divorced themselves from radio. They realize that's where their bread is buttered.
But I think the surveys still show that something along the lines of 98% of people during the week listen to the radio at some point or another. You know, even with the internet, there isn't any technology that has that kind of penetration into people's lives like that.
Broadcasters, according to a story published in Radio World Online, broadcasters are saying the main beneficiary of this act is going to be record labels, and that royalties will be a huge financial burden on radio station operators. Now, I'm part owner of 4 radio stations that play music. Two of them are in American Samoa, which has no treaty with the United States for intellectual property rights. So those stations in Samoa don't have to write a check to BMI or ASCAP or CSAC. But our stations in Mississippi certainly do. And Tom, I'm sure Buckley has some music stations, and Chris Tobin, all of us have music stations, yeah?
Kirk, you have, I hear a theme here. Rich guy's house, good meat, places that don't have treaties with the United States.
Gretchen Wilson.
Yeah, Gretchen Wilson. I'm starting to concern myself about exactly how is the funding at the at Kirk's house here. What's going on?
I will disclaim myself further. My wonderful job with Telos Omni and Axia is held to support my radio habit.
Yes, and one of the principals lives outside the United States. Okay.
No. All the principals live in the U.S.
I'm only kidding. Just trying to make sure everyone's listening.
Well, now, I live in Nashville, so I have a number of friends. Well, I've got a good friend who is a songwriter and a performer herself. And we were having a discussion at her house a few days ago. I was telling her, look, I hate writing that check to ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. And she says, yeah, but when you write that check to BMI, that's how I get paid. I said, I know that. I know that, Ginger, but I still don't like writing that check at all.
See, the beneficiaries of this act are definitely the record labels. And the record labels are spinning out of control and trying to figure out how to take their old model and continue using it and putting a new skin on it. And that's why the radio industry needs to step up and say, folks, this is the reality. Stop it. And they're not going to. You know, ASCAP, BMI serve a purpose.
Now, by the way, this Senate legislation was just out of committee, hasn't reached the floor. And for what it's worth, Senator Arlen Specter said it would be some time before any legislation would reach the Senate floor. The NAB believes it has 251 House and 26 Senate members on its side of the issue. Although that's enough to defeat any legislation in the full bodies, including the latest Senator James Imhoff of Oklahoma. That's the latest, apparently, friend of broadcasters. So,
well, you know, I saw this interesting headline tonight. Radio World magazine sends around this Leslie report. And as we all know, probably in a lot of our states, you know, there are distracted driving laws about using cell phones, and you can't use a handheld cell phone. And other things when you're driving. Headline is just a driver distraction issue could include radio.
Oh my gosh.
It says radio needs to pay attention to the distracted driving discussions taking place on the Hill. Two bills introduced in Congress focus on banning texting while driving, but they don't exclude other distractions. Including cell phones and quote unquote other distracting devices.
Well, you know, in Wisconsin, we were having that because we're just in the process of investigating in those laws. And one of the arguments is the current distracted driving laws can cover all of that. You know, it's distracted driving is distracted driving. If they feel that it's because you're listening to the radio or texting, I mean, it covers all of that. So really, you know, where do you draw the line here?
You know, I in Tennessee, where I live, they've outlawed of course, texting while driving, although you can still hold a cell phone to your head, I believe. The only time that I have ever driven off the road and into a freaking ditch was when I was tuning my radio and I was a block from the transmitter site.
Oh, jeez.
And this ditch was 12 feet deep, so it was quite a mess.
Oh, I bet. Good Lord.
Wow, that's so you think they might be trying to strengthen the laws already on the books or reinterpret them? Do people who are punching on the radio buttons potentially have a problem if they have a wreck?
Right now it says they're going to focus on commercial drivers, but one of the things that's very disturbing in here, for example, Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, ticked off several other distractions like maps and the hundreds of channels of satellite radio in the car.
Ooh, well, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Tom and I were talking before the show, and Tom's biggest distraction while driving is when he uses his epilady.
Nice.
You're just jealous that I won't lend it to you. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't tell you. Every time my wife and I are getting ready to go somewhere, and we're running late, which is every time, She says, I'll put my makeup on in the car. Now, this is fine as long as I'm driving. But she also says it when she's late to work and she's driving.
Don't you love that?
I'll put my makeup on in the car.
My favorite is having somebody reading a newspaper while they're tooling down the road.
Oh,
I've seen that. Yeah, that's unbelievable.
I've seen that, too. Yes, definitely.
All right. Well, let's move to our topic of a half-hour discussion here. The timer starts now, and we're going to talk about different methods of studio-to-transmitter links, because this is an interesting topic. As a person myself who's a sales manager for a company that makes some products that can be used as studio-to-transmitter links, this question comes before me quite often. Not only how can I make this work, what are my options, what quality will I gain or suffer by using this method or that method, but also where do I put my audio processing? And I, for some reason, as a broadcast engineer, I've always taken a special interest in this notion of a studio-to-transmitter link. For years, tell you, the first STL I ever saw was a 950 megahertz, and this is there's a small amount of frequencies allocated to broadcasters to transmit over the air their audio from their studio to a remote transmitter site. And this is the 950 megahertz STL band. And my first experience was with a Mosley 303.
Ah, yes.
Oh, oldie.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I think we had, in the morning when I came into work at this public radio station, I had to turn it on and then immediately kneel and pray. And,
well, you know, I think the back of them said the frequency and so. So it'd be like 950, 475. Or so.
So for the audience, let's describe some of the methods here. I'll enumerate a couple, and we'll take turns. So there's there's phone lines. First of all, the incumbent telephone companies for years in the past would lease clean special phone lines to broadcasters, which they would equalize. In other words, they would make the frequency response flat or as close as possible to flat between 50 hertz and 15 kilohertz in the case of FM stations, and maybe a bit less for AM stations. And you would actually pay the phone company $100 or $200 or $500 a month. You would put your audio into a phone line that they brought to the studio. And it didn't have a dial tone. It was just a blank pair of wires that they would specially treat. And then at the transmitter site, they would equalize this to be a flat frequency response. And if you were a stereo FM station, they would try to give you two lines that followed the same exact path so that you would have good phase relationship between the left channel and the right channel. I remember also ordering these for an AM stereo station back in the 1980s. And I had to tell the phone company that they weren't equalizing it right. They had to get the coils out of the line to make the frequency response flat. So phone company lines are one way. And in the past, maybe 10 years or so, incumbent phone companies have been switching to digital services, which replace the old analog services. Whether they behave better or not is open to discussion. Another method that I'll finish up on is over a 950 megahertz radio. So this is near microwave frequencies. It's very high UHF frequency, 950 megahertz. And a broadcaster would be licensed to transmit a few watts with some particular radio. And there were two methods of doing this. There was a method where you would transmit the mono channel in the case of an AM station, or the left channel and the right channel on separate carriers in the 950 megahertz region. And typically these would be combined into the same antenna, two transmitters, maybe one on 949.750 megahertz, another one on 950.250 megahertz. And these would be transmitted as a pair of carriers to the transmitter site, where there would be one antenna split to two separate receivers. And so you'd carry the left and the right channel separately out to the transmitter site. These systems, by the way, typically were made by Marti Electronics, but sometimes others. Another method typically used by FM stations was called the composite method, where the audio processor and indeed the stereo generator for an FM station would be at the studio site, and the entire composite baseband signal, this is the left plus right, the stereo pilot, and the left minus right, and perhaps any other subcarriers above that, would be introduced into a composite STL transmitter and carried as a whole signal to the transmitter site, where it was demodulated from its 950 megahertz or so carrier into a baseband or composite signal, and then carried into the FM exciter of the transmitter, and then transmitted from that. So those methods had been in use for several decades, and mid to late 1990s, we started looking at other methods of getting our station audio to the transmitter site. So let me open it up to our other co-hosts. Maybe someone can tell me about something like a CatLink or other T1 telephone services, and maybe some other methods. Tom Ray?
Well, why don't we stay with the 950 megahertz for a minute?
Okay.
You can now do a digital signal over and transmit an AES digital audio signal over that 950 megahertz.
Oh, that's right. I remember now, when these first came out, they actually used bit rate reduction or compression like MP3 or MP2 compression.
Right, but what those were is that was a digital modem that plugged into the analog radio. Now you actually have a digital radio that transmits a digital carrier.
Ah, okay. You're speaking of for example, the Harris CD link?
And the Harris CD link or the Bosley...
Starlink,
yes.
Yep. Oh, okay, so you can put analog or perhaps AES EBU into one end at the studio.
And get it out the other side.
At the other end, you get bit for bit the same audio out the other end. Is that right?
You hope you do, yes.
yeah, okay.
And of course, my personal favorite, but we're talking remote transmitter sites, is having the transmitter site on site and having two pair of 8451.
So you have the transmitter very, very close by. Hey, guys, I want to pause our STL discussion for 1 second, and I'm very honored to bring in the host of tonight's meal, my friend Eric Huser. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Hi.
Hello, Eric.
Eric is the owner of a company called VEC, or VEC, which is a very large broadcast equipment distributor in Argentina. And, Eric, thank you for being our distributor. I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for being you.
and
sorry for my English, but I have very bad... I cannot talk tonight. I have how you call that in English?
Eric was yelling at me all day. That's the problem.
Now, that's right.
We're attending a convention here in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and I'm pleasured to be in the booth of VEC and hosted by Eric and also his son... Federico, yes.
Federico Hoyser.
And thank you for your hospitality to all
thank
of us.
You.
I appreciate
thank
it.
You.
All right. And, oh, thank you for the internet bandwidth tonight.
That is a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thank okay. You. All right, Tom, back to what you were saying about digital STLs on 950.
Oh, yes. But the nice thing about the 950 links now is that, for example, if you have an HD radio station, you can also transmit the HD radio data up that 950 megahertz pipe in addition to the AES audio, and you can even couple in your
remote control on that.
Ah, so
it's only single direction.
Yeah.
But you can multiplex a whole bunch of things.
So the 950 technology is indeed a single direction. It's not bidirectional. It's from the studio to the transmitter only, and that includes, for example, if you have some data commands or something like this, it's unidirectional. Yeah.
Yes, it's one direction only, unfortunately.
And let me explore this one thing for just a moment with you, Tom. You mentioned about HD radio, and mm-hmm. it seems that in the first days of HD radio, we would transmit two whole program streams, perhaps one for the FM and one for the HD1, maybe another one for the HD2, and the encoding gear was all at the transmitter site.
That's correct.
So we had a lot of bandwidth to transmit between the studio and the transmitter mm-hmm. site. We were trying to put linear audio from one end to the other. But now the companies who provide HD radio equipment, they've developed equipment to put the HD encoding gear at the studio. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. What you have at the transmitter site now is you have the exciter, especially in the case of an FM station. And the exciter generates the analog signal, also generates the HD radio data components that are transmitted into the... or over the air on the FM station. Back at the studio side, you've got all the encoding for the HD radio equipment. It takes it and packages it and makes a nice little package and sends it up the either the 950 megahertz pipe or over a T1. It hits the exciter. The exciter then takes that information and populates the HD carriers.
So this is a heck of a savings in bandwidth between the studio and the transmitter, because when the HD radio codecs do their jobs for the HD1, which is a duplicate of the analog, and the HD2, and perhaps even an HD3, you end up with a maximum 100 kilobits per second, 100 kilobits per second or so data stream. Yeah.
The HD radio data stream itself is 96 kilobits. Okay. When you transmit it, you've got overhead, you've got signaling, you've got sync bits and everything else. So you're talking about 140 kilobits by the time you're done. So it fits in actually a relatively small space. The beauty of being able to take the encoding and everything back to the studio, you can have the processing at your disposal at the studio. God forbid one of the computers, because these are computers, if a computer locks up, you don't have to travel 25 miles to the transmitter site. It's sitting right there. Makes life much simpler if you're trying to interface title and artist data from the automation system into the HD radio stream, because everything is right there in front of you instead of part of it's over here at the studio and part of it's at the transmitter site, and you can't be in two places at once.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, okay. All right. So are a lot of stations using this kind of technology, perhaps from Mosley or maybe TFT, any others, to get 950, over 950 megahertz to get their FM and HD, or maybe their AM and HD data to the transmitter?
I would say there's probably more stations than you would think. Matter of fact, we ran into a problem with one of our stations in Monterey the other day. It turns out they had a data transmitter on using the same antennas as the STL that started glitching or spiking, actually, and it was glitching the digital STL. But they're using a digital STL at our FM in Hartford. We're using a T1. At WOR, we have two T1s on fiber. We have a 950 megahertz link that goes through a repeater. We have ISDN going to the transmitter. We don't want to be off the air.
Do you have these multiple different links? And I was going to get to that. In big cities, especially stations that can't afford to be off the air for a moment, you have more than one way to get audio to the transmitter side.
That's true. And there are other ways. And if I'm not mistaken, Chris Tobin over at one of your stations, or maybe a couple of them, you're using a 5.8 gigahertz unlicensed link, aren't you?
Yes, we're using that at WINS.
We'll get on to Chris Tarr in just a minute, because I know he's got some interesting STLs too. But Chris Tobin, you've got several stations there with CBS Radio in New York City. Three AMs, and how many FMs do you have there?
It's three AMs and three FFs.
Okay.
We've got six stations in the market, eight T1s. Running all over the place from one location.
Oh, wow. Okay. So
yeah, we do use Interplex.
Interplex, for our listeners, that's a brand name of equipment that takes your audio and puts it into a format that fits on a particular kind of phone line, yeah?
Yes, that would be it's a T1 frame. Interplex is a brand name. There are many other companies making similar products. Takes your audio and converts it to either MPEG or APTX and places it up on a T1 carrier. It's a TDM frame, time domain multiplexer, so you can do whatever you like within the 1.5 megabit frame time slots of a T1. So the 24 time slots, 23 time slots. We're using it now for program audio, LAN connectivity, data for the remote controls, data for our news service from Associated Press from their transmitter site. So we have two locations to grab that from. It's very handy. However, the drawback to one part of that project is the T1s that are terrestrial, we'll use that phrase, go through the local phone company. The 5.8 gig unlicensed link that Tom mentions is a T1 radio and allows me to have full control of my link. And then, you know, anyone who's done business knows if you have full control of your production of your widgets, you control the cost of the business and barrier of entry and everything else.
So the Interplex boxes that you use to format your audio and other data for a telco T1 link, are those the same Interplex boxes used to format the data for the 5.8 gigahertz, or do you have some similar ones for that? Okay.
No. If it's a T1 radio and follows the ANSI standard or the Bellcore standard, then it will work on either. You just unplug the output of the T1 connector and pop it into the radio multiplexer or into the CSU that the phone company provides, the channel service unit.
People often mention, when I mention to engineers that they could use an unlicensed microwave link, they get a little nervous about perhaps other people interfering with that or coming on the same frequency. What's your feeling about interference to an unlicensed 5.8 gigahertz link?
Well, you have to keep in mind that the 5.8 gig and actually many other radio links use spread spectrum technology. There are about six different flavors of spread spectrum technology, and it's designed to work in a environment of interference. So you can control the carriers that can possibly cause interference. You can you hop around different channels within a frequency spectrum. What I've done with our link, because we do have several broadcasters in the New York City market using similar products as mine, I make sure that the gain between the two points of the antennas. Now, you could 5.8 gig antenna could be 1 foot wide, 2 feet, or if you want more gain, 3 feet. Now, if your link budget, the necessary RF signal to ensure a 90% recovery of the signal during worst case conditions of rainfall or snow, whatever, wind, I up it. So I've got like a 20 dB link. So I've got 2 foot dishes on both ends going 10 miles and plenty of RF. So if there's somebody in there trying to be an interfering carrier, it's so way down in the spectrum, I very rarely even notice it. If I do, my bit error rate might go up a little bit, but not enough to cause the T1 chassis, the Interplex chassis, to unlock. So that's a way to get around congestion if you're concerned.
All right. I like it that you mentioned spread spectrum, and the trivia question for the night is, who invented spread spectrum? Hold your answers for now. We'll wait till the end of the show.
Okay.
we'll ask our listeners to hang on, and they can look it up on Wikipedia while we're talking. Hey,
Al Gore's name came up. No, never mind.
Oh.
that inventor?
Chris Tarr, now you're in Milwaukee, not quite as big as New York, but you've got a bunch of stations that you take care of. What are you doing for STL systems there and backups?
Well, we have a couple of interesting things that we've got going on. Now, for our stations in Milwaukee, for example, I only have one that's off-site. With that particular station, I use an Interplex, and that carries all my audio and data. I extend my WAN out there and things like that, as well as remote controls and all that. So that's also backed up with a Mosley, the DSP-6000, which is the analog radio that's converted to do digital. And I also have an auxiliary site. Now, the interesting thing is the auxiliary site is less than a degree off from where the main site is. So I have the RF backup for the Interplex going to the main site, and then that also serves the auxiliary site, which also has ISDN. So I got lots of different backups and ways to get from point A to point B. But another interesting thing that we've done with point-to-point linking or audio linking is we ran into a specific situation in our Madison group where I didn't have any space to put in a satellite receiver. for some syndicated programming. I have all the space in the world in Milwaukee, but not in Madison. So what we've decided to do, we've been running this since probably April. It's been working great, is we got a Comrex access box, and I put the receiver in Milwaukee. Now, the access box can carry closures. It can carry the audio. And so we just placed one on either side. Now, we have, in both sites for internet connectivity, have several bonded T1s. So we have about 5 megabits of data between the two buildings. And I set aside 256K AAC connection that's always on between the two buildings, Milwaukee and Madison. And we just stream the satellite audio and closures down to Madison. So that's how we deliver the satellite programming in Madison from Milwaukee. So we've got all of these different technologies. We've got RF, we've got T1, we've got IP connectivity. So we kind of run the gamut here.
I've used IP for STL as well. I have done that.
So have I.
The company, mm-hmm. WAN, and through a public internet DSL.
What? Public internet? Yeah?
Yeah. Believe it or not, it works very well.
Wow.
Yeah, I did my testing before I got the T1s in. I did my testing over DSL over several days, and although we weren't on the air with it, we monitored it very closely and really had no problems with it.
And there's a station I know of that my son works at. They've been using a Comrex access over the public internet for, 8 months now, because they've been having an issue with their with their 950 megahertz STL license, and works like a champ.
We're going to get to talking about audio processing in a minute, but working for Telos, of course, I see a few orders here and there for various different IP codecs that Telos makes. We make both standard IP codecs, if you will, unintelligent IP codecs, those that just produce IP audio and turn your audio into IP packets, whether it's MP3 or AAC encoded or some flavor of AAC, and then send those to another site where they're picked up, buffered, and decoded and turned back into audio. Telos also makes a codec called the Zephyr IP, which has quite a bit of, connection management intelligence. So if you're using the public internet and your available bandwidth is changing, and the latency from one point to another is changing, if these things are in flux, the sophisticated codec will account for this and will actually increase or deplete the buffer as needed, will change the coding rate if that's needed. So it's pretty interesting things that can be done with codecs, and I think you'll see, I know the folks at Comrex are doing a few similar things to that, and I think you'll see more of this sophistication built into codecs that are intended for use over the public internet, where you don't have quality of service controls on the data. I think you'll see that being used. I'm still a bit nervous about using the public internet as a full-time 24/7 studio to transmitter link. If you're willing to put up with a certain amount of downtime, or occasionally times when you have a click or pop or a bit of dead air, or maybe you're down for 5 hours, then that could be okay. And certainly for some broadcasters, the trade-off for the low expense of doing that is certainly okay. And as a backup, it can be good too. Any other interesting STL methods? There are some regional networks that, or maybe translator networks, that are doing STL via satellite.
I've heard of that.
I've heard of it. I haven't met anyone recently. I do know folks use VSAT for some broadcast continuity planning, backup for disaster recovery, if you will, from their studios to various other studios. If they have a multiple, this is a station group within a region, and they've rented time on a satellite for VSAT, and they'll be able to relocate from the state in the case of a natural disaster, relocate from one studio to another place via the VSAT truck that they've set up, relay it to another studio, and get back on the air that way. As far as an STL full-time, I haven't heard of anybody doing that.
Well, I think there are some either public and or some religious broadcasters who have translators, and they're affectionately called satellators, because in the non-commercial band, you're allowed to send audio to a translator via a method that's not over the air. In other words, it can be a an out-of-band, or a satellite or some other terrestrial link that's not your actual on-air signal.
I know what you're talking about now. Yes, I have come across those non-commercials.
So let's turn our focus for a few minutes now. Unless somebody has anything else to add about STLs themselves, I'd like to talk about audio processing and where that's placed. Okay. Hearing no objection. So the company I work for, Telos, does coded audio links. And also Omnia does audio processing. So we end up answering a lot of questions of engineers. Where do I put my audio processing? How can I maximize the value from my audio processing? How can I make sure I'm loud on the air and sound as good as possible? And probably the general rule of thumb, two general rules of thumb that I've always lived by, A, it's always best if the audio processing is as close as possible to the transmitter. Physically close. And back in the early days of FM broadcasting, this was even very important to have a short length of coaxial cable between the stereo generator and the exciter, as these were not systems that could stand up with very much capacitance in the physical link between the stereo generator and the exciter. But that was a long time ago, back when Benjamin Franklin was around. It's still a good rule of thumb that the processing should be as close as possible to the transmitter for the best control of peaks that modulate the transmitter but don't add anything to a station's loudness or intelligibility. If you have a linear link between the studio and the transmitter, in other words, there's no data compression going on, no audio bitrate reduction, then your audio processing can go at the studio site where maybe it's a better environment, there maybe it's less lightning, it's maybe a more air-conditioned environment, and you can access the controls more easily if you have a linear link between the two sites. So if there's there'll be no overshoot or no peaks added to the processed and clipped audio between the studio and the transmitter site. Something that a lot of folks don't realize or haven't realized in the past is that when you do audio bitrate reduction, I'm talking about MP3 or AAC or APTX or any other kind of bitrate reduction, you always end up adding overshoots in the recovered audio at the other end where you're turning the MP3 or AAC stream back into a real audio, be it AES EBU or be it analog. You will not have maintained the strict level control that an audio processor would have done prior to such bitrate reduction. So in such a case where you have bitrate reduction between the studio and the transmitter, the final processing, and I emphasize the word final, needs to be at the transmitter site after the bitrate reduction system. Now, all this got a little bit more complicated when we added HD radio into the mix, because now we're doing some processing of audio for the HD radio codec. And there are some considerations in there. First, I'm going to turn first to Tom Ray to fill us in on this, because Tom, you were an early adopter of HD radio with WOR, and you have the AM signal to process, and then you have the HD signal to process, and there's different requirements for these two. Tell us about your experience there.
Oh, well, at WOR, the audio processing was at the transmitter site to start with, so that was a natural place, obviously, to put the HD radio processing. And since we've gone to a box I know absolutely nothing about, it's made by this company called Omnia. it's an AM5EX, which actually is a dual box, and it has dual chains. One side is for the AM side. The other side is for the HD radio side. And the requirements for HD radio, you don't want to use any clipping on the audio to control your peaks on the HD radio side, because, of course, it's the old garbage in, garbage out theory. If you start clipping the audio, you start generating harmonics, and the way the codecs tend to work is they're liable to start picking out the fundamental frequencies instead of the harmonics, and all of a sudden you get a big load of garbage on the air. But the nice thing about, a box such as the 5EX, or Orban makes a wonderful box as well. I believe the latest is the 9400 for AM for them. The first several stages, the AGC, followed by the compression, followed by the equalization, is all one chain, so both sides will tend to sound alike. That's where everything then splits. On the AM side, AM broadcasters are only allowed to transmit up to 10 kilohertz audio bandwidth.
And with HD radio, you want to limit that actually to 5 kilohertz, which most radios can't even reproduce. But then what we normally do in AM is you clip the audio at that point, because you can get away with clipping in the analog domain. On the HD radio side, there's no bandwidth restriction. The restriction actually comes in the codec. It's right about 15 kilohertz where the roll-off is for the high frequencies. And you use a look-forward type of limiting instead of clipping, which will actually pull that peak down. The processor will anticipate that it's going to see a peak and actually pulls the output down just a little bit. And that keeps the HD radio side a lot cleaner than the AM side. And you send them off in two different directions to the exciter, and they end up on the air and coming out of your radio sounding pretty well, pretty good.
Hey, I want to interrupt for just a second here. We're going to get to what Chris and Chris have to add about this, but I've just been informed that Rich Parker of Vermont Public Radio is available. I'm dialing him in right now. I've met with Rich a few times and been to a transmitter site or two with him, and he's got some pretty interesting STL situations. Hey, Rich, are you there?
I am here. Hey, Kirk, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Rich, you're online here with Tom Ray, Chris Tarr from Milwaukee, and also Chris Tobin from CBS Radio in New York. Rich, welcome in from Vermont Public Radio.
Hey, guys, thanks. Good to see you. Good to talk to you.
Hey, so, by the way, Rich, you're on the podcast This Week in Radio Tech, which can be found at thisweekinradiotech.com.
Cool.
Also, you can search YouTube for Twirt, TWIRT, as in This Week in Radio Tech.
I've been seeing your posts. I haven't had a chance to watch some of them, but they look really interesting. So, yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, we're audio now, and hopefully in the future we're going to start being a video podcast as soon as the folks at the Twit Network start producing that for us. So hey,
very good.
Rich.
So what's the topic tonight?
Well, yeah, I saw you online, and you and I got to spend a day together in Vermont. And you have described to me several times your elaborate STL system for Vermont Public Radio. Tell us about some of the complexities that you have to go through to get audio from your studios out to all of your transmitter sites throughout the state.
Well, we've got several options, Kirk. We have pretty much traditional stuff from our main studio in Colchester up to our main studio, main transmitter, Mount Mansfield, Vermont. We're using a Starlink system and running that from the studio up to the transmitter, and of course we're also using the UDP modem to get our HD up. So that is duplicated about 180 degrees around behind us to the lake, across the lake to WXR, which is our classical station. But the rest of our network is running off of T1s or fractional T1s, and we're using interplexes. And right now, because of bandwidth limitations, we're choosing to use compression, 384K compression to those sites. And then we're using the rest of the bandwidth for Ethernet to send, I guess you call it I to E, HD, from our studios to those various sites. So we've got nine stations, two of them with traditional STLs, and then the rest of them over some kind of T1. And actually, one of them is an off-air pickup right now because we're waiting. Actually, two of them are an off-air pickup because we're working on getting those STLs in place.
Rich, remind me of the name of that mountain that we were on together working on some audio processing.
Well, let's see. That was Mount Ascutney.
Ascutney, yeah, yeah.
And that's by Windsor, Vermont, in the southeast corner of the state. That has our WNCH and our WVPR. One is our main VPR news channel, and the other is our VPR classical channel.
Do either of both of those run HD?
They both do.
So you've got a lot of audio to get to those sites. Are you putting that HD audio into the, shall we say, the HD domain back at the central studios, or are you doing that at the transmitter site?
A little of both, Kirk. What we've got is we've got the exporters at the sites, but we have the importers at the studio. So we're running two 384K channels up to the site for just the analog audio, and that's like an L2 compression, MP2 compression.
Yeah.
And then we're running 128K of Ethernet. 192K of Ethernet on the Interplex, and we're combining both of the importer to exporter links on that particular channel, on that particular link, and it seems to be working well.
How do you keep track of that? That's just that's a lot of different stuff to keep track of. Tell me about that. We were just beginning to talk about audio processing vis-a-vis your STL and where you do the audio processing. In front of your bit rate reduced paths, where you go to 384 kilobits per second MPEG layer 2, are you doing any kind of audio processing prior to that, or is it just raw audio from your consoles?
Actually, we're using, and this was actually, I believe, some suggestions we got from you and from other people at Omnia. We're using a AFX compeller.
Yeah. So just something to hold the level around the right area.
Right, just kind of keep things a little bit manageable.
Yeah. And then your final transmission limiters, at least on your analog FMs, now these are at the transmitter sites themselves, yeah?
That's correct, they are. We've got Omnias up at the transmitter site. Actually, we've experimented now with a Norman 8500 on one and an Omni on the other, because one's talk and one's classical music.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Rich online with us also. I was just getting around to asking Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin about their situation. If you can hang on the line and finish the discussion out with us, we're probably 5 minutes away from ending the podcast. So can you hang with us, Rich?
Absolutely. I'll listen. Okay. I'd love to hear what they have to say.
So actually, let's move to Chris Tobin about audio processing, Chris, on your STL links. I take it, Chris, yours are typically compressed links, so I'm guessing... processing at the transmitter sites?
We have the processing at the transmitter site. We do pre-process at the studio to keep everything in check across the links. We also use the output of that processing as a dummy air chain for the anchors in the newsroom or the air studios to hear themselves. So
yeah.
I find using that air chain rather than a separate program feed being processed as a dummy chain much more accurate for them. I'm not sure if it's psychoacoustic, what the deal is, but it works better. They have better level control. Everything works the way it should. When I have a separate chain just being fed back to the headphones, processed so they can get that effect, levels are all over the place.
Ah, okay. All right. Your HD channels, Chris, are those being all generated with exporters at the transmitter sites?
Yes. HD is everything at the transmitter site, audio processing for both analog and HD transmitter sites.
So you're delivering full quality, basically unprocessed audio to the transmitter sites? Or, I mean, lightly processed audio?
Lightly processed, yes, yeah. Lightly processed.
Okay. All right. Chris Tarr, how about yourself? You said most of your stations are right there at the studio, is that right?
Right. Well, I have two in the Milwaukee market. I've got two stations on site and then one off site. Now, for all of them, I always use pre-processing anyways in AGC. I'm a big fan of the Ariane box.
Oh, yeah.
So I use those at all my stations.
Yeah.
But what I do is I put the Ariane's in the studio at the point where the audio leaves the studio to the transmitters where the Ariane is. Now, all of my processors are at the transmitters themselves. And I'm also, I'm a big quality hound. So all of our audio, it's a rule. All of our audio is uncompressed wave. The most we do is spots, I believe, is 256K MP2.
Oh, you're talking about your source material is uncompressed on the automation
right, because,
systems. Yeah.
Because no matter what, when you're talking about these links and the audio processing and the HD conversion, you do have a tendency there where stuff, you start to lose bits.
What?
Bits get robbed here and there and you get cascoding codecs and stuff. So you want to start out with the audio being as clean as possible leaving the studio.
By the way, that's going to be a whole nother I'm glad you brought that up. It's going to be a whole nother podcast
about how we
handle audio within our facilities that's under our control. And I'm glad you brought that up because it's so cheap to be linear nowadays. But I'm sorry, Chris, go ahead.
So to finish it off, and then when I use Orban 8500s, and those are all at the transmitter sites, and they have the ability to split analog and HD audio, and it all leaves from there.
Gotcha. All right. Well,
hey, Kurt?
Yes, sir.
I just want to point out, too, that for the HD, I want to put in a plug for the neural reprocessing for the HD 2 and 3. That's been a phenomenal boon for us.
Yeah, these guys are very good at processing for bitrate reduced systems. What would you say is the biggest advantage, Rich, you see with the neural processing?
Well, without getting into a whole bunch of detail, the kind of the base theory of that is that they look at what's being sent, they make some decisions about what really needs to be sent on to the codec.
Yeah.
Things that are just barely stereo, they pretty much just say, well, that's really mono,
yeah.
That kind of thing. And so it makes the HD codecs work a lot less hard. And we've been really, really very, very well pleased with the sound on our HD2 and HD3.
You know, I'll give my standard little spiel about this for the folks who may not realize it. You know, we have audio processors that are intended for the AM transmission system, because the AM transmission system has characteristics that we want to exploit and has weaknesses that we want to avoid. Same for the FM transmission system. Audio processors, and an FM processor is designed for the FM process, the FM transmission system, whether it's the U.S. or other countries that use, say, 75 microseconds of preemphasis, or other countries that use 50 microseconds of preemphasis. We have certain attributes of FM that we want to exploit for our benefit, or we want to minimize things that are liabilities for that system. Same thing for codecs. Codecs are a real moving target for audio, and our goal with a codec, I mean, the goal of a codec anyway, is to take approximately 1.5 to 2 megabits per second of audio data in stereo and reduce that to some very low amount, like 16 kilobits, 64 kilobits, 128 kilobits, or maybe even 384 kilobits. And we want to present audio to a codec in such a way that the codec can be as efficient as possible in encoding that audio. And there's a lot of things that we, and when I say we, I'm speaking of Omnia, but also speaking of the other companies, Orbin and Neural and other companies that make audio processors, a lot of things we've learned about how an audio codec is quite different from an AM modulator or an FM modulator. I'm sorry, go ahead.
If I can jump in for a second, yeah. Just to about that, you mentioned Omnia. I use the Omnia 1 NET processors for my HD2s, and they're phenomenal. And it's a similar thing with their Sensus codec, where, you know, it optimizes the audio output for these for the sample rate of the HD2 encoders. And I'll tell you, it's a night and day difference using one of those processors that's designed for that, as opposed to just plugging in your normal, you know, clipper box or, you know, limiter box. You know, the difference between an optimized processor and just a off the shelf thing is night and day.
Yeah, and I want to say there's nothing wrong with using simple basic processing for a codec, whether it's an HD radio codec or an internet stream. But if you really want to optimize a coded audio stream for internet or for HD radio or for a cell casting, for example, or a podcasting, if you really want to optimize that and get the most out of it like you do with your AM or FM transmitter, you need to look at the options that are available with audio processing specifically meant for a codec. Someday, I'll tell you what, we'll bring Frank Foti, or we'll see if we can get Bob Orban or somebody from Neural in to talk about these attributes that we have to really be careful about in processing audio for a codec to try to improve its efficiency and deliver the most and best and most artifact-free audio to the listener at the other end, so they don't get fatigued, so they really enjoy the audio experience.
Kirk, let me just add too that I want to say that we have some really almost rabid golden ears that listen to our classical service.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Well, I bet.
I'll tell you what, even using the 384, now we happen to be using the Interplex MP2 L2 codecs, but running the 384 into the Omnia, we still have gotten great compliments. Nobody has said, oh, that's not linear, oh, it sounds like artifacts. So there's a point where you can use bit-reduced audio effectively with the kind of processing that's available today.
You know, I was going to ask you that, and so you answered it before I did. And there was a paper put out by the Audio Engineering Society. I got a copy of it somewhere. About codecs and golden ears evaluating audio codecs, whether it be layer 2, layer 3, APTX, the flavors available from Dolby like AC3 and DTS and others, and how, you know, at what bit rate really is reasonable where a golden ears would say, you know, that is just basically artifact free. And the magic number for almost every codec came in at 384 kilobits per second or higher.
Yeah, and that's been our experience.
Yeah. And on broadcasters who are, you know, whose business it is to transmit, hopefully, very good audio, we don't have a problem in most cases, paying for 384 kilobits per second links to transmitter sites, whether we're paying for an RF bandwidth or telco bandwidth or whatever it may be. So for a lot of people, 384 is a very good number to look for in terms of content delivery to a transmission facility. May not be the bit rate of the final link. In HD radio, it certainly wouldn't be. But if you can get it that quality to the wherever it gets finally coded, then we probably have a good chance of sounding good, and that certainly has been Rich's experience.
Well, and let me just throw in, too, Chris added this, that I think is very important. We really are fighting kind of a constant battle with our producers. We really can't use MP3, MP2 stuff effectively from the studio, and that really makes a big difference.
Yeah. Well, guys, we've been at it for over an hour now, and I really appreciate all your participation. Gosh, there's so much more we could talk about, but we're going to have to draw it to a close. So we've been having Rich Parker. Thanks for being our guest on very short notice. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Rich with Vermont Public Radio. Rich, you're the director of engineering for all of Vermont Public Radio. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Tom Ray from Buckley Broadcasting. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Kirk. Look forward to it again.
Chris Tarr, thank you so much for your time from Milwaukee.
You're welcome.
And Chris Tobin, you are in Atlantic City. Where
absolutely.
Please don't lose too much money there, okay?
I won't, trust me.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. And
should we be sending a barrel down tomorrow, Chris?
what about the spread spectrum question?
Oh,
Kirk?
That's right. The spread spectrum question.
Don't forget that.
All right. Yes. The question was, who was the inventor of spread spectrum technology, and who knows the answer?
I can give you the answer.
Famous actress in Hollywood.
Famous actress, yes. In fact, tell you what, before we mention the name, from the first line of the Wikipedia entry, this person was an Austrian-born American actress and scientist. Now, you don't find those two things, those two professions,
in
the same sentence very often. And for all the money in my left pocket, who is it?
Hetty Lamarr.
Exactly.
No
right.
Kidding.
I actually have a little plaque in my office with a picture of her talking about that.
Oh, really?
The advertisement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Hetty Lamarr, American actress and scientist. She passed away in the year 2000, so just about 9 years ago. So. Spread spectrum is a very interesting technology. She developed it and gave it to the military for secret communications.
Right.
And now we use spread spectrum to avoid interference, to transmit bits and bytes from one place to another, and we can have several systems operating in the same area with little or no interference to each other. So.
And I just want to put in a plug that she was also a musician, and that's the key.
Really?
Hmm. Yes, that's exactly it.
Was she play piano? Or anybody know what?
You know, I'm not 100% sure what all the thing, but I mean, it's just that she was able to apply her understanding of musical frequencies and stuff, and she said, "Well, this should work."
I'm amazed. The Wikipedia entry here lists her marriages also. She's married to six guys.
Wow.
Well, I
think she was applying the spread spectrum to the marriage thing.
It's multitasking. frequency hopping.
But yeah. Frequency hopping. It was just one at a time, not multitasking. So. Oh, gosh. Hey, thanks for joining us, guys. Thank you so much. And tune in again next week for another This Week in Radio Tech.